Everybody, welcome in to the Lakers Collective. Happy to have you all here on YouTube. We are live talking Lakers basketball. Yes, apologies, Chad. I see the comments. We're a couple of minutes late. It's my fault. I couldn't figure out how to get us all in the right places. I don't know. It's been a day, but appreciate all of you being here. We've got a lot to talk about today. We've got the return of LeBron James. We've got a healthy Lakers group. What can we expect from them? And is JJ Redick making the correct decisions? We talk about the starting lineup and the rotations. Plus, we're going to be taking your questions and comments. Before we dive into everything, we are on the cusp of hitting 10,000 subscribers on the Lakers Collective channel, which we are beyond thrilled with. If you guys wouldn't mind, help us out. Hit that subscribe button. Get us over the top there. Don't forget to check out the Lakers Collected over on the podcast feed, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. I am Trevor Lane, joined as always by Jason Timpf and Yovan Buha. Guys, how are we doing? Exciting time right now in Lakers basketball.
I'm doing good. We are excited to can we announce that we're going to two episodes a week starting in December?
Well, I guess we just did.
Yeah, we just did. So there we go.
Is that too? So it's we're starting to build some momentum. I just want to shout out all you guys for the support you guys have given the show. This has been a lot of fun. And shout out the Lakers too, because it's a lot easier to do when they're playing good basketball. It can't be complaining about 11-4 through 15 games.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to be going to two times a week. Shout out to everybody in the chat. And yeah, we have a lot to touch on coming off of LeBron's return and year 23 debut, still diamond. Crazy.
Man, was he throwing some passes? Was he throwing some... Yovan, you were at that game, weren't you? The LeBron return game. What was the vibe like in the building?
The vibe was awesome. Yeah. It was first time this season the Lakers have been fully healthy, so I think that there was that element to it all. But LeBron doing the chalk toss and when he went on that stretch with six assists in about 5 minutes between the end of the third quarter into the beginning of the fourth quarter, it was as loud as the building has been this season. And there's just when LeBron gets on one of those runs, obviously that there's not much like it in basketball. So it was a great crowd, and it felt nice to see the team finally at full strength.
Yeah, this is the first time that they've had all 14 of their regular rostered players, not including two-way players, available to play. They had their first full practice with everybody available, and then their first game with everybody available. Jason, what did you see from LeBron's return here? How did that change things for the Lakers?
I just thought he did a really nice job of, kind of easing his way in. I was talking about this on my show yesterday, but like it's crazy how different implementing him is compared to implementing Luka. And I don't mean this as an insult to Luka, but like no one's calling Luka a Swiss Army knife the way that they've referred to LeBron over the years. Luka is just a pure and simply one of the very best on-ball players in the history of the league. So you want him on the ball. And when LeBron was, dominating the way that he was dominating around the trade deadline last year, when both Luka and Anthony Davis were injured, it was a much more complicated situation being like, okay, LeBron and Austin have this thing going. How do we implement one of the great on-ball players in the history of the league into this system? This is much different. Austin and Luka kind of had their thing going, and LeBron is very good at being like, okay, let me deploy my skill set in these very specific ways. And I thought that, especially in the first half, he just kind of was really deliberate about keeping Austin and Luka in rhythm. And I think one of the big takeaways from that game is you still got 60 plus points out of Luka and Austin in a game where LeBron got 12 assists. So like that's a pretty impressive piece of like being really deliberate with your usage. I think that one of the other pieces of it too, LeBron was kind of functioning as an advantage creator. Now, it manifested as assists because the defensive breakdowns were occurring on the first move. So like he would, catch the ball in the post and Jake LaRavia would back cut his man and have a wide open dunk, or he would, spin off of a high side post up where the guy's kind of funneling him towards the baseline and all of a sudden DeAndre Ayton or Ayton would be open for the lob. Like he was being able to convert things on the first read. So that was piling up the assists, but he was essentially just making really quick decisions with the basketball. There was no like excessive dribble probing or anything that would like disrupt the rhythm and flow of the offense. By the way, they had something crazy, like a 134 offensive rating with LeBron on the floor in that game. Like, they were just the wheels were greased when he was out there. And I think, like, obviously, it can we expect LeBron to take seven shots every game for the rest of the season? No, but like, I do think that this is the best way to do this, is have LeBron ease his way in. And yeah, over time, Luka and Austin will both sacrifice a bit of usage, but you want to try to do that without disrupting their rhythm. And I thought, at least for one game, LeBron did a really nice job of doing that.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how he was able to just take what the defense gave, which has been, you know, his MO for much of his career. He's a guy who very much reads what the defense is giving him. Now, the seven shots, you know, 12 assists on one turnover, I don't think we necessarily see that ratio throughout the entire season. I did like the high-level passing from LeBron James. It was great getting everybody involved. There were big smiles all around. Jake LaRavia grinning ear to ear when he had that dunk. DeAndre Ayton was very clearly having the time of his life. But I do think some of that was beyond just LeBron feeling kind of almost a Magic Johnson-esque role for that stretch there. It was the defense that was opening up the pass for him by trying to prevent the shot. That we may see a different strategy on Sunday when they take on the Jazz again, where the shot is the correct basketball play. I don't know. Yova, what do you think? LeBron in this facilitator role, is this the path forward, or was that just the path through that game?
You're muted, Yova.
Yeah, Yova's muted.
My bad. I think it's a combination of both. So, fun fact coming off of that game, that was the fewest shot attempts LeBron has ever attempted in a game that he has completed. So the only two other instances in which he attempted fewer shots were the Solomon Hill game, which everyone remembers from 2021. Mm-hmm. And then I believe in 2004, right before his 20th birthday, he took a shot from Dikembe Mutombo in the first half and only didn't return, only shot five times. So in a full normal game for LeBron, he has never attempted fewer shots than he did in this game.
That's
wild. And I do not, he was sixth on the team in shot attempts. That is not going to sustain, right? I think most nights he's going to be second or third, but we did see, like, the Lakers at times, I think, have been, you know, pre LeBron returning, had been up and down in terms of their execution out of those 4-on-3, 3-on-2 situations. And just, you started teams, you started seeing teams sell out against Luka and Austin and being willing to trap and blitz and live with the results and live with, we could recover in time with the way that some of these guys are processing or not seeing the reads. Now you add LeBron to that, and he could operate in three different distinctions in terms of, he can be the short role playmaker or like the second side, you know, safety valve. He could also be a cutter and a finisher in the lane. And then he could also be a shooter. So he can function in multiple spots on the floor and basically give the Lakers whatever they need off of the ball. So I think it just makes it a lot more difficult to try to sell out against Luka and Austin and trap those guys 30, 35 feet out. And if you do it, LeBron is going to either pick you apart or he's going to get to the rim or get an open three. So I think like he's the guy, to Jason's earlier point, like he is the guy who can do, I think, the most off of the ball of the Lakers big three. So like naturally you're going to ask him to do some of these things that you're not going to necessarily ask Luka or Austin to do. I still think that there needs to be a bit of a balance there. And like, LeBron with the ball in his hands will always be great offense, but naturally based on his catch and shoot ability, the cutting, the screening, the rolling, the finishing, like he can do a multitude of things for this offense. And naturally he should probably be the guy playing a bit more off the ball.
Jason, are you in agreement? LeBron being the kind of the off ball guy, let Luka and Austin create. Where do you see the path forward for LeBron with this Lakers team? And I think the age has to be a factor in this as well when we talk about how much you're putting on the shoulders of LeBron James.
Yeah, so I think having options is a good thing. Like, I think there will be nights where it makes sense. Like, I think the Thunder matchup is a classic example. That strikes me as a type of matchup where, like, yeah, you're going to want to play through LeBron more than you play through a guy like Austin, for example. And, like, I think, you know, I had mentioned earlier how LeBron kind of piled up the assist totals in large part because Utah's defense was breaking down on the first attack, like, every single time. And, like, there's a certain amount of, like, by the way, Utah Jazz fans probably a little reminiscent of the Gobert days when they were playing against the Clippers, when it was, like, one little pick and roll, wide open three and a dunk. But I think when you run into better defenses, you have to be more picky about how you enter the defense. And then there's also a incremental breakdown element. So for example, like there may be a team where, you know, they are capable of switching ball screens, or they are doing something to get the ball out of Luka's hands to where you want to attack through LeBron, or you want to attack through Austin. And I think over time, ideally, you have all three players in rhythm in a way where on a game-to-game basis, you can kind of tweak your offense in the way you're attacking based on how they are defending you and who, what the matchups are and so on and so forth. And then to take it a step further, you know, ultimately, like one of the things the Lakers have been doing a ton of as of late is posting up Luka Doncic and LeBron James, usually off of cross screens, so that they can get him in either good post position or a mismatch. Because if they don't switch, now the guy's trailing the play, so he can get a deeper post catch. If they do switch, now they have an advantage matchup with the smaller player, whoever was guarding Austin on LeBron or Luka. That is more often than not just going to lead to some sort of advantage, a kick out to where somebody can drive a closeout. And this is where having that aggregate talent on the floor, having LeBron and Austin attacking from the weak side, having sequences where you have the type of talent on the floor that can incrementally break down a defense, I ultimately think it's going to be a huge benefit in the big picture. The question is, how do you build the rhythm? I think we can all agree that Luka, Austin, and LeBron together have a substantially higher ceiling offensively than just any two of those of that group. And so how do you get to the point where through repetition and through continuity, you get to these guys like legitimately feeding off of each other and what they can do for each other, so that even if you're not initiating, so there's a version of this where LeBron has a game where he has 27, 28 points and 7-8 assists with very rarely initiating the offense. Like, this happens all around the league. That there's a whole archetype that is the weak side scoring forward. That is what Michael Porter Jr. is. You know, that is what like Lauri Markkanen can be. Like, there's very much a guy that can be a scorer within a system. And to me, that is what all of these guys are capable of being off of each other. And so it's on a game by game basis, figuring out how to attack. And then against the better defenses, making sure you deploy all that talent so that they can feed off of each other.
I want to get to Jovan to ask about LeBron's comment from after the game about fitting in and the criticism that he's received about that. But real quick, there's Super Chat. We are taking Super Chats. We're going to save most of them until the final segment of the show. But we are taking Super Chats. If you guys want to throw questions and comments in, she throws out there with the way OKC behaves, the after game interviews. It's time for them to eat some humble pie, in my opinion. 9th of November, 2026 can't come soon enough. That'll be right after the trade deadline as well.
Be sooner. Don't forget about the in-season tournament.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I'm secretly hoping. I think this Lakers team needs to have a game where they compete against OKC.
I think so too. I think from a mentality perspective, a confidence perspective, they need to have a game where they really show out. And they did well in their first matchup post Luka trade against OKC last year. Maybe would have done better had Luka not gotten kicked out in the second matchup post Luka trade last year. That was still such an egregious call. But
they win that game if Luka doesn't get kicked out.
Right. So that happens, and then we live in the now. We're so reactionary. People would still be upset about the blowout loss to OKC, but maybe it'd make us feel just a teeny bit better if they had gotten both wins last season.
All right. Yeah. So you want to talk about LeBron?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Let's do it. I mean, LeBron sees and hears everything, and he clearly heard some of the chatter that had been out there. I think in the national media, there were people on talk shows and podcasts talking about LeBron is going to make the Lakers worse. He's going to take away from what Luka and AR are doing. And so I think him fitting in what was showing, he said, so we spoke with him at practice, and then we spoke with him again after the game. And in both instances, he said, like, I can do anything on a basketball floor. I can play any role you need me to play. Like, that is what I do. And we saw that they needed that second, you know, it was a lot of hit ahead passes to LeBron. Then LeBron gets downhill, finds a, you know, driving kick opportunity, or LeBron in the post. And then they're running some sort of off ball action. And then he finds a cutter, or he finds a weak side shooter or whatever. It was like LeBron just seamlessly fit in, as we've been discussing for the last 10 minutes. And I think he wanted to make sure that point got across that. No, I'm not going to make the Lakers a worse basketball team. I'm actually going to make them a better one.
Yeah, his quote, I just found it, was, "I can fit in with anybody. I don't even understand why that was even a question. What's wrong with these people out here?" LeBron is, let's face it, he has an army of haters. He has an army of supporters, stands, if you will, as well. So there are people that are going to be looking to be ultra negative about him. But yes, he is an incredibly versatile player. We've been talking about that. And him being able to fit in whatever way the Lakers need is not a surprise. Now, there have been some who've said, well, he's not going to be willing to, because he's got to have the ball in his hands. He's got this giant ego. He needs the basketball. He needs to be putting up 30 points. And to the people that were going to that place, to me, that was a lot of just people who haven't watched LeBron James over the last number of years and didn't really pay attention to what happened post-Luka, if you thought that was going to be LeBron's mindset. I mean, Jason, I'm not surprised at all that LeBron was able to read what that game gave him and say, cool, I'm going to be the facilitator of this game. I'm passing the ball, and just slot right into that role.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a conversation to be had about redundancy. Like, yeah, like if you could... Like, I think Wemby is going to be the best player in the world within a few years, but LeBron's relatively close to Wemby at this point in his career. They're both in that, like, somewhere in the 5 to 12 range in the NBA, which all those guys are pretty close to each other. If you could swap LeBron for Wemby, sure, the Lakers would be better. I agree. There'd be better complementary skill sets and all these different things, but, like, you can't. Like, that's not how it works. Like, you have LeBron. LeBron's the guy you got, and he's 41, so you're not going to trade him for any sort of other comparable star that plays a different position that complements things better. So, like there's a conversation to be had about the redundancy, but, like, ultimately, within this situation and what this team has available on the roster, there was literally no version of this situation where LeBron couldn't help the team, at least to some extent. Now, whether or not he can be perfectly complimentary and become Draymond 3.0, that will determine whether or not they can go win the championship. Sure. Like, if LeBron can be a borderline second team all defense type of player on the back line while also averaging 21 points and 7 assists a game while not disrupting Austin and Luka's offensive rhythm at all, like, that's the ceiling, and that remains to be seen. But, like, no matter what, even just the iterations of LeBron we had seen in previous seasons were going to step in and help this team. Like, I didn't even think LeBron had a particularly good defense and rebounding game, which is, like, super predictable because he's not in shape, and that's going to take a few weeks. But, like, even without that, just his connective playmaking, just little things like, oh, kick aheads in transition, that LeBron's able to make that second read for the guy that's trailing the play for an easy bucket, or him knocking down catch-and-shoot threes, or driving a closeout and hitting a little mid-range jump shot, or, like, just all of these, like, little things that he can do to help the team. Frankly, like, I get it. LeBron's polarizing. There are reasons for that. He can be a little arrogant. He's a little corny sometimes. There are things that LeBron does that rub some people the wrong way. My thing is, like, he's a basketball player. Get over it. But, like, some people can't handle it, and so it affects their judgment. But to me, like, if you were sincerely of the opinion that LeBron was going to hurt this team, or frankly, that he couldn't help this team, I just don't understand what your basketball reasoning is for that sort of thing. And, like, dude, the amount of negativity I saw even within that game, I was working it on playback, but, like, I finished the game and I'm, like, heating up a little bit of food before I go to bed, and I'm just, like, I open up Twitter for 5 minutes and I'm like, oh my god, I'm so glad I wasn't on here during that game, because like anybody who watched that game, and I'm sure we're going to get into this with the starting lineup, they didn't look great for 2.5 quarters. And mm-hmm. You know why? They didn't play good basketball. It wasn't LeBron's fault. There was a bunch of different things that were going on in that game where several guys weren't doing a good enough job. And, like, it just, LeBron, there's always, like, half the discourse with him that you just kind of have to take and remove from the equation, because they're bad actors. They're not talking in good faith. They're just hating, and they can't get over it. There's a conversation to be had about some redundancy, and yeah, you're building around a 41-year-old and all these different things. That's fine, but he is with the Lakers. He's probably not going to get traded. Just look at his skill set and how it fits, and there are a dozen ways that he's going to be able to help this basketball team.
We definitely need to get into the starting lineup, but I agree with you in terms of the conversation around LeBron. It's going to be similar, and maybe even higher volume. In fact, it probably will be higher volume than what we have with Austin Reeves, where if Austin has a bad game, it's trade him, fire him into the sun, get him off the team. If he has a good game, obviously that segment will be very quiet. Same thing with LeBron. If LeBron comes out next game and he is 5-for-18 from the field and gets beat a couple times defensively, it's going to be see Lakers are worse with LeBron. But I want
to really quickly, Trevor, too.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's going to be bad games. They're going to lose one of the next 10, and LeBron's going to be bad, and the guys will look out of it. That's just regular season NBA basketball. And like you're implementing a guy that it's not going to be a linear ascent to the top of the league. It's going to be up and down. And so those are the times where the negativity is going to be really loud and people just got to tune it out.
Exactly. Exactly. Before we move on to the starting lineup, Jovan, real quick, I want to touch upon the defense. I did notice a number of times where LeBron defensively was, you know, maybe a step slow. Maybe he went to contest on a block. It didn't get up as high as he used to. I want to get your opinion. How much of that is, you know, Jason just mentioned his conditioning versus how much of that is, well, he's going to be 41 in a month here.
I think it's more so his conditioning. He said at practice that he has baby lungs right now, which I thought was a hilarious analogy from LeBron. This is a guy who's basically built like Goliath, saying that he has like kid lungs right now. So I think it was largely that, because look, like he's no longer prime Cleveland or Miami LeBron or even prime LA LeBron physically, but he's still one of the best athletes in the NBA, you know, bar none, and it can still do things with the chase down blocks or dunking on guys or whatever that you look like he's 28 years old or 22 years old. So he's no longer as quick or explosive or can jump as high, but I think I thought he looked progressively better throughout the game. He did have a bit of a rough start defensively in terms of the Lakers also switched from 1-4 switching to 1-5 switching. And I think that was a bit of an adjustment for the entire starting group. Mm-hmm. And we saw Utah start to pick on those matchups, and there's a bunch of miscommunication. I mean, functionally, it was a preseason game for LeBron, right? Like this was his first game of the season. You're supposed to have multiple preseason games ramping up into the regular season. He had one practice with this team and then a tune-up game against the Jazz. So I don't want to overreact to that. Maybe if we're having this conversation a month from now and we've seen what LeBron looks like over the course of a month, maybe he is in a different place physically, but I don't want to jump to that conclusion yet based off of one game with this group. Sure. Looking at what he did last season defensively, like I think, I don't know if he's going to get quite back to that level, but I would, you know, edge on the side of him being closer to that than what we saw against Utah.
Okay, let's get into this whole starting lineup conversation. Going into this game, I was on the side of Marcus Smart needs to be in the starting five. After that game, I think I'm more entrenched into that position. Sounds like JJ is going to give the starting five with Rui a real shot. Jovan, I know you were also on the side of starts, but although you jumped around a little bit for a little bit there, you were on Team LaRavia.
I had a little fling with Jake LaRavia. Right?
you did a little LaRavia side quest there. Where do you stand now after this game in terms of the Lakers starting lineup?
I'm firmly entrenched in starting Marcus Smart.
Okay.
And I do acknowledge that I think the Lakers are in a little bit of a tricky spot here, because I think through the first 15 games, there are two developing weaknesses with this team, in my opinion. One is clearly the defensive end, which we already knew going into the offseason and based on the roster construction. Like there was a clear ceiling of, can this team even be like a top 10 defense? Probably not, but can they maybe be like 12th or 13th? I thought like that was a fair expectation in terms of them like hitting their ceiling. Now that might even be a little bit lower. They have been a bottom 10 defense for most of the season. They've had a couple of spike performances that have raised that closer to, I believe they're like 16th or 17th right now. But that to me still projects as like the biggest weakness of this group, especially if Jared Vanderbilt is not going to be in the rotation, which is a totally different conversation. But my thing is, so they were -3 in 12 minutes together, and they got blitzed early, -10. Then Marcus checks in, and you know, then it looked a little bit better throughout. They played again to close the first half, then they played again, obviously, to start the second half. But for me, my standard right now, if I'm the Lakers, is I'm looking at these three juggernauts in the West. I'm looking at OKC, Denver, and Houston. All three teams are blowing everybody out by double digits every game. They both have, or I mean, all three teams have borderline historic net ratings. Like OKC is in its own class, but if OKC did not exist, we'd be talking about how special Denver and Houston are right now with the plus 11 net ratings respectively. And looking at those three teams' starting groups, Houston has had two variations. They're plus 15 and plus 7 points per 100 possessions. OKC's had two starting groups without J-Dub, plus 31 and plus 29. They are literally just blowing teams out of the water. And then Denver's primary starting group, plus 12. So you look at those groups, that they're all winning basically by double digits, if not by even more, you know, high double digits. And the Lakers quartet of Luka, Austin, Rui, and DeAndre, which I think at this point we have enough of a sample size. It's been the highest playing quartet up to this point in the season, plus 3.5. And I just don't think that's good enough. And yes, adding LeBron in, maybe you get that up to like plus 6, plus 7. I think you want a dominant starting lineup that's winning on both sides of the ball. And I just don't think that starting lineup is ever going to be that good defensively. I think there's a clear ceiling there. We saw it, I think, really in both starts to the first and third quarter. Whereas if you swap Marcus Smart in for Rui in that quartet, it jumps up to plus 13.5 points per 100 possessions. All the lineup data up to this point in the season has supported Marcus has been a more impactful player than Rui. Rui has the third worst net rating on-off differential among the rotation guys. Marcus has the second best behind just Austin. So I think, like, to me, for me, Marcus has been the best defender of the primary rotation, even better than Vando, but I'm not even including Vando in the primary rotation right now. So he fills a glaring need. And yes, there are shooting concerns with him. And that's the other thing that LA hasn't been good at. I mentioned earlier, like, it's been the defense and it's been the 3-point shooting. Rui is the 3-point shooter. It's just the defense is not there. He's getting beat off the ball. He's losing guys. He's failing to screen navigate. Like, it's been a problem this season. I think he's been worse defensively than he was last year. And I think the clear answer is Marcus.
Yeah, there was a play early in the game where Rui, his job was to get out to the shooter, who is an active shooter with the ball. And instead, his instinctual step was, I believe, towards Yusuf Nurkic on this play that I'm remembering, and who was being covered on that play by DeAndre. It was like mind-numbing stuff. Jason, where do you land? I believe you were more Team Rui. Where do you land on what the Lakers should be doing with their lineup? And then I want to get into the Jared Vanderbilt of it all. Is it the right decision for him to not be in the rotation?
Yeah, so I think it's complicated because all of these discussions and opinions pretty much come back to the same issue, which is that the Lakers don't have a starting caliber small forward, I should say. And that is the issue ultimately that needs to be solved in order for this team to have any real shot to compete with the Houston, Denver, Oklahoma City tier. And so as we discuss all of these things, there are legitimate downsides to everybody involved. Like, for instance, like, just take Rui and Marcus, for example. If Marcus takes a three, even if it's wide open, I think it's going to be short off the front of the rim. Like, that's just what I think every single time he goes up to shoot. If Rui gets a clean look at three, I think it's going in the basket. So, like, that's a very specific difference between the two of them. I think the biggest issue that the Lakers starters are having is when you take Marcus out and you put a guy like Rui in, you have a lot of guys that don't have natural motor. DeAndre Ayton is not a natural motor type of player. LeBron James at this age in the regular season is not a natural motor player, although I think he is that in the postseason. You know, Rui Hachimura is definitely not a natural motor player. Luka is definitely not a natural motor player. I think Austin is. He's just small and not super athletic, so it doesn't necessarily manifest in any sort of the benefits that come from being a natural motor player. So putting a guy like Marcus Smart in just brings kind of like a natural intensity that to the group that you don't have with Rui. My case with the Rui thing from the start has just been, it's defensible to me. And it's defensible to me for two reasons. One, Rui Hachimura to me is a very important player on this team, at least while he's still on the roster. If he ends up being traded, I guess it becomes more complicated. But as long as he's on the roster, you kind of need to try to keep him mentally engaged. And there is an advantage to keeping him in the starting role. He's openly said so. So I think it at least is worth discussing there. And there is an advantage the Lakers have in their depth, especially with shot creation, to where it's like, yeah, they can afford to maybe be mediocre in the starting group because every end of the second quarter, early third quarter, or excuse me, end of the first quarter, early second quarter, end of the third quarter, early fourth quarter unit is going to have way more shot creation on the floor than any other NBA team. And so they can do some real damage in those units that kind of compensates for some of the issues that they have with the starting group. But the thing that I'm noticing is with Rui, it fits what JJ wants to do with the starters, especially with LeBron around, which is to switch everything, right? And one of the things with switching is like, it can work. Like, there was a lot of talk about how bad they were on defense to start that game. And like, I thought, yeah, certainly the lack of team speed and some of the lack of intensity was on display, but like, that group is capable of playing better defense than they did. Like, there were two specific issues, I'd say three specific issues they were having with their defense to start that game. On their switches, they were switching soft. So when a player would come off a screen, the switching defender would be too far back so that player could just calmly settle into jump shots off of the handoff or off the dribble, whatever it was, and rise up and knock a shot down. Secondly, inside seals. So like the guy would come up and set a screen, and so the defender that's getting switched off the ball would be stuck on the high side, and then that guy would slip into the lane and get hit, and he'd get an easy layup or start, you know, essentially that initial penetration that would break down the Laker defense. And then I thought they were sloppy in their help and rotation on the backside. Like, there's a version of it where you switch up the touch and the guy that's coming off the ball does a good job of peeling off and getting underneath so that he can take away the slip. And as a team, you're more connected in your help and in recover situations. All of a sudden, that can be a functioning kind of like contain the ball and make the right guys take jump shots style of defense. It can work. Now, the question is, with those all poor motor players, with all those guys that don't naturally play super hard, are they going to consistently come out every game and play like they did at the start of the Jazz game? That's not sustainable. That's where you're going to start digging yourself into some holes that are tough to overcome. So my whole thing with it is I'm okay with JJ giving this a little bit of runway. I'm okay with him giving them 5 to 10 games to be like, hey, we're going to start Rui. We're going to switch everything. This is what the expectation is. Let's see if it works. And if 5 to 10 games down the line, they're still coming out flat every game because they're just lacking that little bit of energy and intensity, and they're soft switching and they're giving up inside position and they're not helping and recovering on the backside, then JJ has to sit there and go, whatever theoretical potential this group has, it's not materializing because of the lack of intensity when you come out in games. Now we're going to have to do, you know, Marcus Smart. We're going to have to chase over the top on those primary actions involving Ayton and Smart and like come up with some different approach from there. But like, to me, even if you implement Marcus Smart into the equation, there is an intensity advantage. And for the record, I agree with you guys. I think the lineup data is difficult to argue with at this point. I think Marcus is probably the guy that certainly should close games at that three spot, if not start. But the big picture problem always comes back to me. They don't have a starting caliber three. And so that every single option you go with there is going to have some sort of shortcoming.
I think it's a fair point that ultimately the correct answer is not on the Lakers roster yet. And hopefully they will be. And we'll see what happens on the trade front. But Jovan, is there a version of this? Because you and I are both on the side of start Marcus Smart. Jason brought up that mentally, and the chat has brought this up too, that mentally Rui, having him in the starting lineup, you're probably going to be getting a better version of Rui Hachimura as a starter. It seems to matter more to Rui that he starts than Marcus Smart starts. You're going to get, in terms of their how locked in each guy is, Marcus Smart is going to be Marcus Smart, whether he's coming off the bench or whether he's in the starting lineup. It may not be true of Rui Hachimura. So is there a way that you can structure the rotations to still nominally have Rui be in your starting five, but capitalize on Smart getting the lion's share of the opportunities with that starting group? Is that do you think JJ Redick can thread that needle?
Yeah, and I mean, I think he's trying to do that right now with subbing in Smart for LeBron. Like, I think there's also an element of trying to stagger LeBron and Rui, and I think there's a more natural, like, I think ideal version of starting Smart would be then Rui is the first sub for LeBron. LeBron likes to check out around that 7-6 minute mark. And then you're staggering a bit more of LeBron and Rui, who I think have some overlap positionally just in terms of their strengths and the way that they function both offensively and defensively. My other thing, though, to follow up on what Jason was just saying is, like, I think the soft switching has been an issue for most of the season between last year and, like, the 1-3, 1-4. And one of the few guys that consistently does not soft switch is Marcus Smart. Exactly. And I actually think seeing, like, I you know, in rewatching the game, I thought he did a really good job switched onto Lauri Markkanen. And this has been something we've talked about before with Smart. Like, he probably defends up better than he defends down. So I actually liked his minutes against Markkanen more than I liked his possessions against Keyonte George. So I actually think, though, like, when you're switching this much, there is, like, the on-ball component, but there's also the off-ball component. And that's where I've had some real issues with Rui's defense this year is, I mean, to Trevor's point, there's that possession in the corner right in front of the Lakers bench mm-hmm. where Ace Bailey attacks the closeout, gets right by Luka, and Rui, they were zoning up initially that possession against the ball. And Rui is that rotation. Rui is supposed to be the low man there rotating to stop the Ace Bailey drive. For some reason, right as Ace Bailey starts the drive, he rotates backwards to Jusuf Nurkić. And it's like, defense 101 that you learn in elementary school is stop the ball, and you're supposed to rotate over there, not rotate away from it. Then there's another possession where he's tracking Ace Bailey, and then it's just a simple curl from Ace, like Ace Bailey gives the ball up. It's a simple give and go curl where he curls around Jusuf Nurkić hits him over the top, and he gets a reverse layup. And it's just like very basic mistakes from Rui that I think he continually does and I think has regressed in this season. Again, going back to last season, he was a part of the Lakers being that best defense in the league for 24 games, but I don't think we've consistently seen that player for a lot of the season. So I think based on the guy that we've seen so far, I do have real concerns of, like, I think teams are also targeting him more. We've seen teams, like, look for Rui and bringing him into the action. And then, like, Keyonte George was blown by him multiple possessions in that game. So I think there is a way to probably appease him mentally and keep him as a starter. But I also thought, like, we saw he played, what, 26 minutes and Marcus played 17, whereas going into the game, Rui was at 34, Marcus was at about 29, 30. So I think that's too big of a gap between those two guys. And I don't know if Marcus was coming off an illness. I don't know how much of this had to do with potentially them just trying to, like, limit him. But I think if it's also going to dramatically change the way that they're playing in terms of, like, playing time, that's where I have more of an issue with this. On top of just in general, I think they're barely going to be winning the starting minutes against, like, even mediocre teams that I think that's a bit of a problem.
Guys, we got some breaking news. This just came out from Shams Charania. The Lakers are reorganizing their basketball operations department and terminating executives Joey and Jesse Buss from their respective front office positions, effective immediately. Statement from Joey and Jesse Buss: we are extremely honored to have been part of this organization for the last 20 seasons. Thank you to Lakers Nation for embracing our family every step of the way. We wish things could be different with the way our time ended with the team. At times like this, we wish we could ask our dad what he would think about it all.
Wow.
Jovan, let me get your closest with the team. Let me get your initial reaction to Joey and Jesse Buss being terminated in their roles.
Okay. Yeah, this is a lot to process.
Right? I mean that's look, I don't mean to just throw it on you and put it on
you. Say go, Jovan.
You know, let me say that while Jovan's collecting his thoughts here for a moment.
Yeah.
That we have largely seen Joey and Jesse Buss for years now in conversations I've had and everything else that they've been really good at their jobs, that they've done very well in their positions. Obviously, we've got new ownership coming into place with Mark Walter. So, you know, this has got to be factored in here somewhere. What this is going to mean for the entire front office, we'll have to see. But generally, this wouldn't be seen as a performance issue because they are viewed in pretty high regard around the NBA.
Yeah, so, sorry, my phone's going off now. I mean, the writing was on the wall with both the sale of the team and them launching that new sports acquisition business called Buss Capital. So I think it was trending in this direction. It was unclear, you know, I've clearly the way that this has been trending in terms of, like, the front office has been that they're probably going to revamp it or bolster it. But I wasn't sure how involved they were going to be or if they were going to be potentially marginalized. So obviously, like, this is breaking right now, and I'm trying to, you know, find out more information as we go. But I think the first reaction is, like, again, based on the sale, like, you know, we can now say clearly that they were the two that voted against the sale, right? It was 4-2 among the Buss siblings, and they wanted to keep the team and keep it in their ownership and one day inherit it and be the two primary people running it. So the fact that they ended up selling, I think at that point, that was probably the sign that they were going to be either marginalized or moved on from entirely. And I do think it is a blow from a scouting perspective. Like, they, you know, so Jesse's been the one who's been the you know, one of the primary scouting voices. And if you look at the Lakers track record over the last 15 years, they've had a lot more hits than misses in the draft. And Jesse's been a big part of that. And then Joey has been running the G League team, which the Lakers have had one of the best G League operations over the last decade or so. And, you know, kind of in you know, concert with Jesse, like, that's been a lot of the South Bay guys. And even if they haven't panned out as Lakers necessarily, just looking at guys like Scottie Pippen or Jay Huff, who've gone on to be successful NBA role players, like, those were all Lakers discoveries. So I do think if we look at the last 15 years, I think the best thing the front office has done has consistently been finding these gems in the second round, undrafted, G League, whatever. And, like, Joey and Jesse have been a big part of that. So I am interested to see how they go about replacing that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be interesting to see how the whole front office, kind of this restructuring that Shams Charania is talking about, is ultimately going to shake out. What is this going to look like under Mark Walter? Does this mean other things are going to be happening as well? Was this a one-off move here? Where does all of this go from here with the Lakers front office? Jason, I know you're not as tuned into all the front office stuff, but obviously this is a big change here for the Lakers. And based on the statement, it doesn't sound like this was something that this is not a mutual thing. This is not Jesse and Joey saying we are going to, you know, go spend more time with family or something like that. This is termination here. What, give us your thoughts.
So let's take Joey and Jesse and set them aside for a second. The Lakers are going to be fine. Mark Walters, they're going to find competent professionals to fill those roles. They're going to pay well. They're going to be competitive in the marketplace. And the Lakers will have smart basketball people that are hunting in the draft and that are making those, like, supporting decisions for the front office in terms of talent acquisition at the, you know, at the youth level. Right. So, like, I think that's important to disclose up front. Like, I don't think they're going to get rid of Joey and Jesse and hand the keys over to Kurt Rambis. Like, it's not, like, this is part of the attempt from the new ownership group to make this less of a small family business and more of a real life, dead serious NBA franchise. So that's the first piece of this that we can set to the side. Looking at Joey and Jesse, what's unfortunate about it is when you look at the parochial small family business way the team was run over the course of the last, you know, decade and a half since Dr. Buss passed away, it's like those are the two that I think have been at least making the most sincere effort to educate themselves on the NBA and become basketball experts. They're like, you know, Jim Buss was very much like I'm going to sell the future for the present, anything I can do to get the slightly better team for this next season. And there was such a lack of big picture perspective that he consistently handicapped the team and he needed to go. And he obviously was responsible for those big issues surrounding the cap spike in the mid 2010s. Right. And then, you know, I would say with Jeannie, it's just a complete reliance on her friends, which has led to her depending on certain things, like a guy like Kurt Rambis, who is allegedly an experienced, you know, kind of guy who's been around the league for a long time, but has pretty consistently revealed himself to be a guy who wasn't very successful relative to other NBA players, coaches, talent evaluators, right? So, like, I think there's a certain amount, like, when you look at the Buss family in general, the Joey and Jesse kind of stand out from the masses as the ones who truly put in the effort to educate themselves and to be the best possible basketball executives they can be. Jovan, I think, laid it out really well. Like, There have been some misses, particularly at the top of the draft. I'd argue that's been their biggest weakness. But arguably, when you get to the top of the draft, from everything that I've heard at least, it hasn't always been Joey and Jesse's decision ultimately with some of those top-end picks. But there have been some misses, obviously. Dalton hasn't panned out the way that you would hope. Obviously, Jalen Hood-Schifino didn't pan out. Taking Alonzo Ball over Jason Tatum. There's a lot of examples of higher-end draft picks that have missed. But I agree with Jovan. When you zoom out, especially with some of the hits, like turning a guy like Austin is like a bona fide top 30 player in the NBA and you got him undrafted. Like there are legitimate wins in there. And frankly, if you start looking everywhere around the league, even in Oklahoma City, they've had successes because of the sheer amount of opportunity they've had in the draft, but they've had a lot of misses too. Guys that have been hurt, guys that haven't been very good. And so like the truth of the matter is the draft is kind of a crapshoot no matter what. And Joey and Jesse have done better than most. And so I feel bad for Joey and Jesse because out of all of the family members, I think they were the best in terms of legitimately talented basketball executives. And it'll be hard for me to imagine them finding another opportunity. So that's kind of unfortunate for them. But on the flip side, let's be clear, like Mark Walters coming in here to run a professional basketball team, and he's going to put good, talented people in their positions. And I think the Lakers front office will ultimately, as soon as they get, you know, especially from the top down, when they reorganize there, I think ultimately the Lakers front office will be better for all of this.
And the Buss family, Joey and Jesse, they will retain a minority ownership stake in the team. So they're not losing that in this decision here. Mark Walter, though, coming in, as you mentioned, there we should see the areas where we should see the Mark Walter effect is when it comes to hiring coaches, when it comes to hiring front office personnel, when it comes to facilities, things of that nature. The NBA has a salary cap. It's collectively bargained. There is only so much you can do. You can't suddenly go buy Shohei Ohtani and defer his contract in the NBA. That can't happen in the NBA. So where we're going to see the effect is in front office personnel, in coaching, in facilities, things of that nature that we'll see that really impact having this new ownership. And so I do think that we'll get obviously the best that Mark Walter could find coming into, and the Lakers can find coming into these new roles in this reorganized front office. But I guess from here, Jovan, is this the beginning? Or is this just a move and then everything settles and we move forward from here? Or do you think there's more to come?
You're muted again.
Sorry. Sorry. My phone's been going off, so I've been trying to mute it when I'm off. I don't have a clear answer right now, but what I will say, and you know, I grew up a Laker fan, so the Buses have been in my life basically since I was a little kid, and I do feel like this is a sad ending to the tenure, right? Like you go through the years and one of the big things with Jeannie was she would say that like she was never going to sell the team because that's not what her father wanted. And she wanted to honor his legacy. And I think it had gotten to the point where we can't acknowledge, like, I think Mark Walter obviously purchasing the majority stake in the team is good for the fan base. It's good for the organization. I think it is going to elevate them into that, as we've discussed before, like that stratosphere of the best run organizations that also are spending the most. And that combination, you add in like the Lakers legacy, what the brand means, the tradition, the history, that could put the Lakers in an untouchable spot in the NBA. At the same time, like Dr. Buss obviously bought this team, 50 years ago. And just was passed on through his children, and like they had been a big part of it, and they have had the legacy and the tradition, and it just feels like them. I mean, if we're calling it what it is, like they were fired, like terminated is fired. So to have to sell the team at a point that we were not necessarily expecting it to be sold, even though there had been some murmurs about it, and then to fire two of his sons in the beginning of the season. When, like, again, I don't think there's been anything they've done that's been like fireable, at least to my knowledge. It's a little bit of a sad ending, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, sorry, I'm getting messages to you as we're trying to respond on the fly to all of this. Man, this is, Very much a surprise, and as you say, a surprise, because look, I'm older than you guys, and the Buss family's been part of the Lakers organization for as long as I remember, from before I was even born. So this has been, look, change is tough, and it is going to be weird seeing less Buss involvement in this Lakers team. Of course, Jeannie still in her role, but Joey and Jesse have largely done a good job, and so it'll be interesting to see how they ultimately proceed from here. How do they reorganize this team and get things set up the way they want on the front office side? Man, this was out of
crazy news, man.
To me, this was out of left field. I was not expecting this to be coming.
It felt like I guess to kind of continue on the side point for a second, like it just felt like this would probably be something they did in the offseason, where it's like there's a big reorg. They move on. They can say they parted ways or whatever, and then they add whatever, 1 to 2 people that they want to add as like the primary decision makers alongside Rob. But to do this, I mean, again, this is just like speculating, but you know, maybe they were trying to do that or in the process of doing that, and then they were not on board with that, and they were like, all right, then we're going to have to terminate. Like, I don't have the full story right now. So I do expect there's going to be some fallout from this. I think that there will certainly be, the big ESPN piece is going to be coming with inside the Lakers breakup.
Right.
I still ultimately think this is for the best. I think like
long-term, like, yeah, I agree.
For the best. Or even short-term, not we'll necessarily see. The specific firing, quote unquote, of Joey and Jesse, but I do think revamping the Lakers front office was something we all knew was coming and something that needed to happen. To put it very simply, the Laker front office has lacked any coherent basketball vision for the last decade. No clear, like, this is what we believe in. No clear, like, this style of player is a Lakers basketball player. No consistency in approach offseason to offseason. No real big picture plan. Like there's been a severe lack of like on track, like all people pulling in the same direction type of identity with this front office over the last decade. And so, you know, ultimately, like for instance, like let's say you got a coaching staff that needs to get, you know, tossed as part of a fire, like just Darvin Ham getting fired, for instance. Like ultimately, usually when that sort of thing happens, it doesn't mean the entire staff is bad. It doesn't mean there's not a good assistant or two in there. Like sometimes this is just how it goes. When you go to revamp an entire front office, there are going to be good professionals in that system that are going to lose their jobs. And it's unfortunate, but I think that when we talk about the Lakers front office 5 years from now, we're going to be talking about them in a much more positive light than we did the last 5 years.
Yeah, and hopefully that is indeed the case, and it becomes this, you know, well-oiled machine, particularly as we see the Dodgers, you know, routinely, despite what some of the naysayers may think about them ruining baseball or whatever. They're seen as one of the best run organizations, if not the best run organization in baseball. And hopefully that is the light that the Lakers are in, despite the admitted a little bit of sadness here from the Lakers side of things, certainly seeing what's going on with the Buss.
Joey and Jesse did a good job. They deserve to be acknowledged for that.
For sure. Okay.
Question
in terms of, yeah, let's go to Q&A, because I know we could talk about what we're going to be watching for with Healthy Lakers and all that when we get to our show next week, which we will not be doing a show on Thanksgiving next week. We're discussing that right now, probably looking at doing one the day before. We'll probably do something on Wednesday. But let me get into some of the Q&A, the super chat questions here. Jonathan said, floor general LeBron is back with the fire emoji. That was cool to see. I was getting, as somebody who grew up during the Showtime era, I was getting Magic Johnson flashbacks when I was watching some of the passes LeBron was throwing. Just a 6'8", 6'9" guy out there throwing the passes that he was. That was pretty damn cool.
Yeah, you know, LeBron is one of the great passers in the history of the game. It's been kind of cool to watch, too, because, like, Luka is such a good playmaker, and I do think he's one of the upper-tier playmakers in this league, but I think Luka's obviously a much better player than LeBron at this point in his career overall. But LeBron has like even an additional layer to his ability to kind of read things before they happen. And there's kind of a relentlessness to his read making because he's such a pass first player at this point in his career. Like it was just fun to watch. And frankly, I found myself feeling very thankful that in November of 2025, we got to watch LeBron James play basketball. And it just is a, I hope we never take that for granted, because it's pretty freaking insane, man.
I think the people that are going out of their way, and we talked about this kind of subgroup earlier, but those that are going out of their way and over the top to just hate on every single thing the man does, I say it all the time, he could save puppies from a burning building and then find a way to spin it into a negative way. But 10 years from now, those people are going to regret. They're going to look back and they're going to go, man, I wish I had appreciated a great player while we were still getting to see him play on a nightly basis. Guys, what do you think about this? The LeBron-Luka pick and roll should be impossible to defend. Why don't we really? No, we've only seen one game back. But should we see more of a LeBron-Luka pick and roll? And then why or why not?
I mean, this has been something I've been clamoring for going back to last season. I was a big proponent for them running more two-man game with those two specifically. I think the obvious counterpoint or counter argument against it is just that there will be some teams, like let's say Boston is healthy, or even take like Orlando, if you have like Franz and Paolo in the mix guarding Luka and LeBron, or if it is a healthy Boston, it's Tatum and Jaylen Brown, it's a little trickier or you know, more difficult to create an advantage when you're just switching that. And if it's two like-sized defenders where it's basically the same, like Luka's going to have the same advantage that he has against Tatum as he probably is against Brown, and vice versa with LeBron, where I think there is a clear path to them running more two-man game is like an example I used from last season was Indiana, where they'd put Pascal Siakam on LeBron and Andrew Nembhard on Luka. And now if you can run a pick and roll and get that switched, Luka should be able to create some separation against Siakam, even though he's a pretty good switch defender. And then LeBron can go into the post against Nembhard, and that's an obvious mismatch that then is going to cause Indiana to double or rotate over. And then that's when you get some of the off-ball stuff. So I think it is a bit like matchup based, depending on how teams are going to guard them, especially if like you have put a center on LeBron, which some teams will do, and just kind of try to live with that. Then if you could get that center switched on to Luka, that's where I think, you know, he can cook and beat that player off the dribble. So I think it is partly based on how teams are defending and their defensive personnel, how much that makes sense. But in general, I agree that I think it's an action that the Lakers have not gone to enough. And we've seen the LeBron Austin pick and roll through the years be a hallmark for LA's offense, especially in crunch time and in just fourth quarters in general. I would like to see more of that with LeBron and Luka. They did ramp it up a little bit in the Minnesota series. If you look at it, like they kind of doubled the frequency or so, but still not to, you know, not enough in my opinion.
Yeah, Jovan broke it down perfectly. It's just a really switchable action because they're going to be guarded by very similar types of players. That said, I'm with Jovan. I'd like to see it a little bit more for a couple of different reasons. One, I think like there are some specific matchups where teams don't have two really big athletic forwards that can guard them both, and so you can get some more favorable matchups for either of them to try to hunt. The second piece of it that I would say is like there's other different things you can do to attack switching. Like if LeBron, say LeBron starts underneath the basket and he sprints up and sets like a back screen on Luka's man while he has the ball, and LeBron's man then essentially closes out to Luka to try to meet him on the other side of the switch, and LeBron now is on the bottom of that defender, he can basically run up and screen and then immediately slip to the middle, and Luka can pitch it over the top, basically an inside seal, kind of some of the stuff that we saw Utah doing to the Lakers. There are ways to essentially beat switching with inside position. The Celtics used to do this forever with Jason Tatum. They would have Jason Tatum run up and set a screen and then immediately slip right to the foul line area, and they just pitch it over the top, and he would have inside position as a big target that you could kind of throw the ball over the top to. The other thing I would add is just three-man action. I think one of the ways to make switching more difficult is to involve Austin as well. And when you have all three of them involved, you can have situations like that where LeBron is effectively screening for Luka, but it's harder to switch, and you can get some advantages out of that. But I thought Jovan broke it down really well. It's a very switchable action.
Yeah, I love the back screen. Utah ran it a bunch. The Lakers run it every once in a while. They've got a little play. They run with LaRavia doing it, but it's definitely something that I think could work if we're going to run that. we do need to get into a few more of these chat questions and comments. Before we do, a quick reminder, everybody, we got a lot of you in here right now. Please make sure you do hit the subscribe button. If you're not subscribed yet, you're just discovering the Lakers Collective here, hit that subscribe button as we're looking to get over 10,000 subscribers here on the channel. And we're going to give a quick shout out to our sponsor. We will be back in 30 seconds to take more of your chat questions. We'll be right back.
Sleeper is the number one fantasy sports app. It pays to know sports. Pick more or less on top players. Your first pick is on us, so start winning now. Play in Texas, Georgia, Minnesota, and 27 more states. Pick anytime across all sports, pregame or live. Over 10 million players are already on Sleeper. Make your picks count. Score up to 1,000 times your cash. Join today. Get up to $100 credit using code HMA. Call your shot on Sleeper. Download now.
Okay, let's get into some of our questions and comments here. We'll finish out with a few of these. We'll go kind of rapid fire here. Diego said, DA's game reminds me of Pau without his passing chops. I mean, in terms of the soft touch, I can get that piece to it. But Pau also, and DA has done a decent job reading the floor when he's put into that advantageous situation, when it's a 4-on-3 and he's got the ball right around the free throw line, he's got to make a decision. He's done fine there. Pau had a different level of feel for the game though, compared to DeAndre Ayton. And then Pau defensively, the super long wingspan, DA has it too, but Pau, his timing as a shot blocker as well, I think differentiates the two. Between the two, of course, Pau, no question, is the better player, but I do get it a little bit, the soft touch around the rim in terms of the Pau vibes. I don't know, Jovan, where are you at? DA versus Pau Gasol?
Well, I mean, it's clearly it's Pau.
I know.
I think I can see what he means. Like there, you know, Powell had you mentioned the touch and you know, the mid-range jumper, and he could be someone who short rolled into some of those, you know, long twos. But I think without the passing chops is a big part of it, because one thing I've consistently harped on with DeAndre Ayton has been the turnovers and getting stripped a ton. And I don't think he's anywhere, like they're not even in the same ballpark, that they're not in the same city in terms of like the passing and the decision-making and processing offensively. I think that's a real gap between these two. I would even argue like DA might be the better overall rim protector. Like I know Powell was more of a shot blocker than him, but you could maybe argue that DA with that is like that. That's maybe one thing he's better at than Pau. That mid-range jumper is automatic, but overall, like Pau was, I think Pau was ahead of his time. And had he played in today's game, he would have been at an even higher level. We're seeing similar things from like Jokic and Şengün and Sabonis and that big archetype of skilled big who can pass and shoot and just do all these things. But even then, he had a certain level of length and defensive versatility that I don't think any of those three guys can quite match on that end. So, yeah, I mean, I if you squint, you could see it, right, a little bit. But yep. I think that without the passing chops is a big part of the Pau game.
He's a super unique player. Like, you know, there's not really a player in the league right now that plays like DeAndre Ayton. And, you know, ironically, I keep coming back to the guy he was compared to coming out of the draft, which is David Robinson. Now, obviously, a ton of unfulfilled potential there. And so I'm not trying to compare Ayton to David Robinson per se. But like on the nights where he plays to his potential, on those nights where he puts up, you know, in that 20 to 25 points, 10 to 15 rebounds kind of night, it's a lot of that stuff. The freaky athletic gifts around the basket, the rim pressure rolling to the basket, like the never taking threes, but having some of that mid-range proficiency on the pop and face-up game, a little bit of a back-to-basket game. Like, to me, like, he in many ways has become just a very poor man's version of David Robinson in this league.
You know what I think is more interesting than DA or Pau? You got to flip two letters. It's AD or Pau is the more interesting comparison, I think, to make which one you go with.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah. All right, let's go here. This question got asked twice. Moussa Cisse is what the Lakers need in the paint. Are we even that worried about what the Lakers need in the paint right now? Because to me, I don't have that as the, in terms of what the Lakers need to go acquire, I don't have more bigs as I could. Sure, you could add one, but I don't have it as like the primary need for this team.
No, to me, it's a secondary need. Like I think there are a couple of like the clear need, as we've all discussed, I feel like every show now, because it is just the glaring need with this group, is that fifth starter who's probably not, I mean, not even probably, is not on the team. I think the ideal fifth starter, a guy that can be a clear positive on both sides of the ball, that player is not on the team. And that is the player that the Lakers need to acquire, I think, to really ascend into that OKC Denver conversation, or at least have a real shot, in my opinion, against that level of opponent. But I think they could use a different look at backup center. I don't think they necessarily need to replace Jackson at the backup five. I think the one thing looking at, if we're saying Ayton, Hayes, Kleba, and even Vando to a degree, although he seems to be on the outskirts of the rotation, I still think there's a physicality and strength and just like mass component that the Lakers are a bit lighter at the center spot compared to, like, if we're looking at some of these other teams, Steven Adams, Isaiah Hartenstein, Jokic, you know, they just don't really compete from just a pure strength and like pushing people around in the paint. That's not really the strength of the Lakers center group. So I think I would like to have like that option if I'm designing a team, right? And not like we saw, I mean, even against like Nurkic, was getting the better end of Jackson at times, and Nurkic is a very limited player compared to some of the names I just mentioned. So I think it is a little bit of a secondary concern, but I think the primary one is like they have to get that fifth starter.
Yeah, you know, I don't think the Lakers center rotation has enough area of opportunity. I agree with Jovan. Like, if you could somehow convert Jackson into some beast of a big man rebounder type, that'd be great. But you're not going to get that for, you know, some low salary filler in a, you know, without including some substantial draft compensation, which I just think would be a poor allocation of resources. The truth of the matter is Austin and Luka in particular have been doing such an amazing job of pulling opposing bigs out to the perimeter that Ayton and Jackson are feasting inside. Like, the two of those guys did a ton of damage on the offensive glass against Utah, and they've done a ton of damage on the roll all season. I love that each of them kind of has a unique complement. Like, Ayton's been really good with Austin, and Jackson's been really good with Luka, and each of them have had success with each other, so to speak, you know, swapping those positions. And so I think I don't view the center position as it's not that I, obviously, you'd prefer to have a better, you know, backup center in there, like Jovan said, a more beefy type of guy. It's just not a realistic type of target. To me, the ideal trade outcome for the Lakers would be a starting caliber three and a good athlete off the bench. Like, if they came out of the deadline with Herb Jones and Oshae Igbaji, I'd be thrilled. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, this is the win of the century. A guy that can come in and play two shifts a game that is a freaky athlete like an Oshae, and a dude who's like a bona fide starting caliber two-way three to slot between Luka and LeBron. That to me is like all of the resource allocation in this deadline should be geared in that direction. And if you can't get a Herb Jones, then they need to try to get, you know, maybe one or two of those kind of bench style wings at a discount.
Love that. Love that. 41-year-old LeBron playing like prime magic. Chef Lev says, yeah, we talked about LeBron's passing a bunch, but loved what we saw from him, the way he was moving the basketball, getting everybody involved. Samuel said, do each of you believe the Lakers right now are definitively the second best team in the West, or are there some votes for Houston? Thanks, guys. The show is goated. I actually have them as maybe the fourth in the West behind Denver, Houston, and OKC. Where are you guys at?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why Denver is not being mentioned here. They're better than Houston. So I think we could debate, like, I think there are still some questions about Houston's offense long term. They are number one in the league right now. So it seems a little ridiculous to even pose that question. But like, in crunch time of a playoff game, I think that there could be some, like, there have been some clunky stretches for Houston offensively with the learning curve of Amen Thompson and Reed Shepard taking on a larger role and running a lot of the offense through Şengün and KD. But I think the big distinction here that I want to make, and I know a lot of Laker fans have the Lakers as number two or number three, but to my earlier point, OKC, Denver, and Houston are both, or all three, top seven on both sides of the ball. The Lakers are not top seven on either side of the ball right now. And yes, adding LeBron, I think they will ascend into that mark offensively. But these two teams these three teams are so well balanced that it's just like they're blowing again. They all have double digit net ratings right now. They have 7 to 8 point advantages over the Lakers just in net rating. The Lakers' biggest problem right now is that I think the three best teams in the league are all in the West, and that's the level of competition they have to compete with.
100% agree with Jovan. I'd have them fourth. I think they're clearly the best team in the second tier in the West. I'm pretty high on Houston. I think they're every bit as good as Denver and Oklahoma City. I think they have like a weirdness that they play with that is a huge advantage. Historically, teams like Denver, Milwaukee, when Giannis was at his absolute peak next to Brooke Lopez and Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday, or like Golden State. Like when you play like a really weird style, there's a big advantage in the postseason too, because it can catch teams off guard by just like completely shifting the way that you play in a 2-week period. But I want to be clear too, like, I think the Lakers could enter that group even with just a slight tweak at the deadline if several things go their way. Like if LeBron plays at an All-NBA level. If LeBron plays at a second-team All-NBA level and Luka plays at an MVP level and Austin is playing like an All-Star, like I think they can enter into that conversation. But they haven't demonstrated anything like that yet. Now, one thing I would say, LeBron's only played one game. Is there a version of this where they're, you know, instead of 11-4, they're 13-2 or 12-3, and they have they competed against Oklahoma City and they beat Golden State on opening night, and the offense is fourth and the defense is 12th, and we're now considering them with Denver, Houston, and Oklahoma City? Yeah, but I'm not comfortable putting them into that conversation based on a theoretical. Like the big thing that I would say is they've played 45 games worth. They have 15 games with three stars, right? So you've got 45 games of potential starts for your three stars, and they've gotten 24 starts out of their three stars. So I'm thrilled with where they're at. I absolutely think they can enter that group, but Jovan very well laid out, like there is a statistical performance that just hasn't manifested with this Laker team to join that group. That said, I think they're clearly the best team in that second tier in the West.
Yeah, agreed. Don't have them in that top three, but in that second tier for sure. If Trevor, Jason, and Jovan are the big three of Lakers reporting, which one of you is Luka, LeBron, AR? I have no idea.
Trevor has to be LeBron, right? Because he's the elder statesman.
Because
he's
I'm old. Thank you, Jason.
Roles, you know? Listen, I'll take the salary for any of those three guys.
That's right. All right, let's go here. Kevin, so back in 2024, Mavs traded 28 swap to OKC for 24 Clippers first, then flipped that for Gafford. LA should trade the 30 swap to OKC for their own 26 first. OKC doesn't need a very late first. Lakers get another first to work with. I don't know. I mean, Sam Presti has his collection of shiny draft picks in his back room there that, you know, I don't know if he's ready to part with any of those at any given time or if he even needs to. So I wouldn't just assume that a trade like that, trading a future swap for a first round pick now, is on the table for the Lakers to make that kind of move. In theory, would it be nice for them to add another first round pick and open some things up that way, and then have, you know, multiple firsts to potentially move on from? But sure, it would be. But you also have to keep in mind that with the although you'd have a second first you could move this year, so that would open up a 2026 first for them to potentially trade if they needed to. But again, I wouldn't just assume that OKC would be, just because it happened one other time, that they're ready and willing to make this type of trade now.
Or what incentive does Sam Presti have to help the Lakers?
That too. Yeah. Yep. All right, let's go here. Scoldilock said, I feel like the problem is starting really requires us to run a switching scheme. Ayton is at his best in drop. Drop also protects our weaker defenders. I mean, it depends on who your opponent is too. Like you run drop against Steph Curry and you're just dead. You know, it's not just what is best for the Lakers. It's going to be what is the best option for the opponent that's in front of you.
We talked about this earlier in the show, but to me, it's less about what scheme you run and whether or not you execute it. And like the Lakers did not execute their switching scheme well to start against Utah. And like we talked about, if they go 5-10 games and they continue to come out passive and not do a good job in their switching scheme, then I think you have to switch things up. But to be very clear, there's a version of this where they can, with that lineup, switch everything and be better than they have been.
My one concern with, because I agree, like to me, the thing I've been comparing it to the last couple of days is the D'Angelo Russell situation, where it was And, you know, especially with, I don't know if you guys saw the Mike Brown quote in the huddle.
Yeah, I did.
Find D'Lo. But it felt like similar things with D'Lo, where he was in a contract year and he was the fifth guy in that starting lineup. And because of some level of internal politics or them feeling like they couldn't move him to the bench, they started D'Lo. And then 8 games in, it was like, we have to move D'Lo to the bench. And the plan was to start Max Christie, but he got off to the slow start. So they eventually went to Cam Reddish. Then they went to Dalton. Then they ended up back at Max. It feels like we might need to see the 5 to 10 games that Jason has referenced. My one concern is that the Lakers have a pretty easy schedule coming up here. So there might be a little bit of a fool's gold element where it might not matter whether this lineup can defend or not. They might just beat some of the opponents that they could reel off. If you look at the schedule, they could easily reel off like a 7 or 8 game win streak here. They're on a 3-game win streak already. And now maybe within that, the starters are like +4 per 100 possessions, and they're still kind of underperforming. And then the next loss, JJ can look at it and be like, hey, we need to mix things up. But I do think like the way that this is trending, we might not even have a realistic view of what this group could do together, just because they're playing a lot of bottom 10 teams over the next couple of weeks.
Maybe we need
a tough schedule to start the season. It's lightened up just last couple of games, but they had been, I mean, the record they have, considering the opponents they've played and who they've had available, I mean, they've been pretty damn good. Jovan's right. Like, this is actually a little bit of respite. I think they only have 10 games in December.
Yeah, and it's a fairly light schedule when we look at what's going on here. But I was just going to say, we may need to invest in a breaking news button, because now we just got another update. Dave McMenamin, in addition to Joey and Jesse being terminated by the Los Angeles Lakers on Thursday, much of the scouting staff has also been let go. So
it's just funny to me, because objectively, the last 10 to 15 years, the scouting department has been the best part of the Lakers front office.
Right. Yeah, that's the strange part. They have done a pretty damn good job, especially finding players in the second round. Guys, I know people will point to, well, this guy didn't work out, that guy didn't work out, but your hit rate is low when you're talking about late draft picks. The fact that they found guys, and again, not all of them hit as Lakers, but you know, your Max Christie's of the world, the Scottie Pippen Juniors, the, you know, we talked about Jay Huff, the Grizzlies capitalized on some of these guys. That's not easy to do, to land those guys. So it's a bit of a surprise the scouting department is effectively completely being changed over now. Be interesting to see how they move forward here. All right,
let's hire good people. They shell out the money and they hire good people. It will ultimately be okay. But yeah, it is. You guys are absolutely right. It was the one bright spot.
L9 says Palinka next. I mean, we don't know. I would be surprised.
I don't think
How much longer is this contract? Like 5 years?
It's, I think, through 2029, 2030, something like that. It's through the decade.
The one I'm looking forward to is the Kurt Rambis one. As soon as he is no longer involved in any decision-making of any sort, I think that's when the Lakers will start.
Well, as you say that, here's a super chat that said, no damn sense the Rambi are still employed over the bus boys. How many Lakers picks are still in the league? I think there's in general a negative perception of Kurt and Linda Rambis from fans of what they do within the Lakers organization. But I also think there's also not a great understanding of what it is that they do within the Lakers organization. And we tend to take the negative things and we put it on them. So I don't want to just jump on like, oh, the general sentiment is they're bad. They must be bad. They're terrible. They're doing all these things wrong. I've heard both positive and negative about them from the organization. So there's
the stuff about him shoehorning himself into coaches' meetings and trying to force his way into coaching staffs is true. Like, that's just frankly outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that part of it. All right, let's go here. Do you all think this could be related to the gambling investigation? The funny thing is now, like, anytime like a questionable call late in the game, oh, it's the gambling investigation. See, we have no sense of that or that being the case. Obviously, hopefully that's nothing to do with it or anything, but I would not jump to that conclusion.
Did you guys see the guy who was harassing Jimmy Butler for betting is over on a 30-point night? Did you guys see that video?
That was wild.
He was harassing Jimmy Butler. I wanted to be like, bro, you bet on Jimmy Butler getting 30 points in the year 2025.
Did he say he bet like $3,000 or something? It was like a high number. I was like, you bet who's betting like $3,000 on?
Did he bet like $2,000? Yeah, it's like
Jimmy Butler scoring 30 points. That's a pretty big bet. No, I don't think so. I think this is more to do with the sale of the team and some of the, let's say, internal politics.
All right, let's go here. Kispert, would you get him for Maxey or Vando and Dalton? I mean, you're adding shooting, but certainly not the defense that we've been talking about.
The Lakers don't have a ton of like actually deadly knockdown shooters. So like if I wouldn't be necessarily opposed to getting a guy like that as part of a deal where you get, you know, like if you, I just wouldn't include draft compensation for a shooter. It'd be a luxury.
Well, I mean, I could safely say you're not getting him for Vando. That Vando contract is going to be very difficult to move without draft compensation. I mean, they just signed him to an extension, so I don't see why they would sign him to the extension and then just get off of it for a player like Maxey. Or I mean, maybe Maxey and Dalton, if they view Dalton as like a longer term better fit. But I really like Kispert, and I think Kispert is going to have a moment on a different team. Like some contender is going to snatch him up at some point, and he's going to have, I think, like a big playoff run with some group.
All right, let's go here. King Rifa said, I remember Braun in high school in Slam Magazine. Hated him during his Miami years, but now regret it because the highlights are amazing. What are y'all's favorite Laker Braun or non-Laker Braun moments? Man.
2018 LeBron was a revelation. It was the best basketball player at the absolute peak, best basketball player ever at the absolute peak of his powers. Like if you, anybody in the chat who is a LeBron fan who rooted for LeBron during the 2018 Cavs season, especially after the trade, after he got the information that the trade was coming. So basically like when the game, from the game that he hit the game winner over Jimmy Butler, the little one legged fadeaway after he blocked Jimmy in help side on the other end of the floor, from that moment, basically through the NBA finals was like, it was like every game it was watching a guy who was far and away better than everyone else in the world, who was playing a level of basketball that we had never seen before. Like it was that whole season was a revelation.
For me, I would say either the 25 straight points he had against the Pistons in 07. And then that helped them finally get past Detroit, get to the finals. You know, I think it was game five technically, but you know, that was a big win for them. And then 2016, I mean the block on Iguodala, that was, you know, that series is one of the all time series.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was going with the 25 straight points personally. Gabe Vincent, Maxey, Vando in a second. For Jeremy Grant, Reith, Jeremy Grant is playing much better this season, shooting the ball at a much higher clip than he was last year. I'm still wary of that contract.
It's a really tough contract.
It's a tough contract to take on, and that's the challenge. Wiggins for Rui and a first.
Like for perspective here, Wiggins? He's making 32, 34.2, 36.4. So that probably, if you trade for Jeremy Grant, that probably costs you DeAndre Ayton or Rui next summer. You're probably not keeping both of those guys. So would you rather have Jeremy Grant at 30-something versus Rui at maybe low 20s or Ayton high teens, low 20s? Like, I think I'd rather have either one of those guys.
I also think he's ultimately a four. That, you know, kind of plays the same position as LeBron. And as far as the Wiggins thing goes, I've said this like a half dozen times on the show, but like if you told me that the world was going to end next summer, I would trade for Wiggins in a heartbeat. But I totally understand the hesitance around doing that with the big picture goals. That's why a guy like Herb Jones becomes so much more, you know, kind of like he just becomes such a more positive type of move for the future. But to me, Andrew Wiggins legitimately solves almost every issue for the starting line. Like he's a bona fide guard, the other team's best player. He's an excellent rebounder, a very, very good athlete. He's having a good offensive season. He can hit spot up threes. He can drive closeouts. He can run second side action. I think Wiggins would be perfect. He's just in his 30s. And so it just always is complicated when you're considering giving up a first round pick when your two foundational guards, Luka and Austin, are in their mid 20s.
Yeah, agreed, 100%. That's going to be the challenge. And to, with everything we look at, yes, I think this team is good enough to invest in. We're going to see more of them over the coming weeks. But I think they're good enough to invest in right now to go add pieces. If that means moving future draft capital, you have to do it smartly. You have to make sure that you're making the correct moves. But we also have to factor into every decision, what does that mean for your future flexibility this summer? They are projected right now to be one of the higher cap space teams in the NBA this summer. There is an opportunity cost to taking on any salary, whether it's a Jeremy Grant, Andrew Wiggins, or anybody else. And so I think they've got to make sure that if they're going to make that move and go all in right now, which I absolutely think they should be aggressive doing it, they just have to make sure that it's going to be worth that opportunity cost of limiting their own flexibility over the summer, or as Rob Pelinka likes to say, the optionality, right? That's the word. But everybody, we are not going to get to all of the super chats here. We do have to run. All of us have some stuff to jump off to, but I will save them and we will get to them. So we will get to those. We won't get to all of them on this show, but we do want to say thank you guys very much for joining us here today. If you haven't done so yet, please make sure you do subscribe. Guys, I know we are still very new in this endeavor here, but Jovan, Jason, this has very quickly become one of my very favorite parts of the entire week. Thank you guys for jumping on, and this was an absolute blast.
Yeah, we get to do it twice soon, so I'm excited about that. I similarly have really enjoyed this. I know we got to run, but this has been a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to next week.
That's right.
Appreciate you guys. Shout out to the chat as always, and I'm looking forward to moving this to twice a week.
Absolutely. That's coming soon. Again, I'm going to save those super chats, so don't worry, we will get to them. Till next time, everybody. See ya, and stay safe.